This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. According to the World Health Organization, 14 million people die every year from infectious diseases. A disproportionate number of these deaths occur in developing nations. Different diseases pose different medical and political problems, and to get a better idea of what's involved, today we look at the very different battles against two diseases, polio and malaria. After a massive worldwide effort, polio is said to be on the brink of extinction, or so it seemed until WHO announced this week that outbreaks in Nigeria and the Darfur region of Sudan could soon develop into epidemics. With malaria, eradication is a very distant dream. It's by far the biggest killer. A 2004 report by UNICEF said nearly 3,000 children die of malaria in sub-Saharan Africa every day. Later in the program, an update on today's Supreme Court rulings that affect hundreds of people on death row and the lawsuit over Vice President Cheney's Energy Task Force. But first, the global fight against disease. If you have experience in public health, especially overseas, or if you have questions about the scientific and political priorities of global health organizations, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from the WHO studios in Geneva, Switzerland, is David Heymann, the former executive director of communicable diseases for the World Health Organization. And it's good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks very much, Neil.
Let's begin with polio. What is it about this disease that lends it to the ambitious and very difficult policy of eradication?
Well, polio is a disease that handicaps children. It disables them, it paralyzes them, and then they can not grow up as a normal child, and they can't produce economically when they're adults. This disease has been with us for many, many, many centuries. And in the 1950s, as you know, vaccines were developed that could prevent infection with this disease. So the first reason that we can eradicate this disease is because there is an effective vaccine which prevents infection and which lasts, the immunity of which lasts for a lifetime.
Well, then the question then is delivering that medication to all the people who need it at the right time. Is that it?
That's right. It's a matter of getting this vaccine to the children who need it. Mm-hmm. Now, every country in the world has a routine immunization program which uses polio vaccine. But in some areas, especially in sub-Saharan Africa and parts of Asia, it's been very difficult for these programs to get the percentage of children protected against polio above 30 or 40%. So added on top of that, to eradicate the disease, are immunization campaigns where all children under the age of 5 are targeted for 3 or more doses of vaccine on national immunization days or on subnational immunization days. These two elements, routine immunizations and campaigns, are the strategy that will eventually eradicate polio from the world.
So the problems now, obviously, it's not a question of medicine. You have the medicine you need. Is the problem now politics or is it money?
Well, the problem is certainly getting the vaccine to those children. In countries with weak health infrastructure, it's necessary to have volunteers, and here's where Rotary International plays a big role, because they've mobilized in many countries the volunteers to do the vaccinations, because these are just simple vaccinations done by 2 drops into the mouth of a child. Mm-hmm. At the same time, UNICEF, another partner in polio eradication, works with countries to increase demand for vaccine among parents by explaining why vaccinations are needed. And finally, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta and WHO provide technical guidance to countries and help countries in implementing their programs to eradicate the disease.
Tell us more now about the areas where polio outbreaks are happening.
Well, last year at this time, polio was endemic in only 6 countries. That means polio was only transmitting from human to human in 6 countries. All the other countries in the world had interrupted transmission, eradicated the disease from those countries. Those countries that still had polio at this time were India, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Egypt, Niger, and Nigeria. This year, unfortunately, we still have those 6 countries endemic. But the picture of polio is changing. In Asia, in India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and in Egypt, polio is at its lowest levels ever. And if commitment continues and campaigns continue, polio will be interrupted from transmitting in these countries by the end of this year. In Africa, the story is a bit different. Unfortunately, for reasons of false rumors about polio vaccine in the north of Nigeria, immunization activities were stopped last August. And since then, polio has continued to transmit in northern Nigeria, infecting other parts of Nigeria that were polio-free, and also infecting 10 countries outside of Nigeria, because the virus went from Nigeria to those countries in people who were infected, and those countries didn't have enough protection in their children to prevent polio outbreaks. So now we see polio in 6 endemic countries, countries which have always had it, and in 10 countries which one had eradicated polio and now again have the disease.
So it's a slippery devil. How communicable is it? Once an outbreak has occurred, do you have to start again at ground zero?
Well, polio is caused by a virus, and it's transmitted from human to human by poor sanitation. When feces from a person who's infected with polio contaminate the environment, and when that environment contaminates a human, then transmission occurs. So the important thing is to make sure that children living in these types of environments have the vaccine so that they can be protected. And that's been the challenge, getting the level of protection, a level of children protected, high enough so that polio can be eradicated.
If you'd like to join our conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address totn@npr.org. And let's talk with Barbara, who's in Dowagiac, Michigan. Am I getting that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
In the last year and a half, I have immunized door-to-door with local volunteers as a Rotarian and part of a team of Rotarians coming from the U.S., in both Nigeria, Kano, Nigeria, and Niger. I feel firmly and strongly that we cannot stop immunizing. We must get past this roadblock in Nigeria and help these people to help us have a polio-free world.
Tell us a little bit more about the roadblock in Nigeria, Barbara.
In Nigeria, they are not well informed. They are people who care about their children. In some cases, I have seen mothers who have chosen to have their children immunized but wanted it done without recording being done so that there would not be repercussions through their religious community. I see a religious community that has some prejudice of the West, but I see people who love their children. By going door to door, and as an American taking pictures of my children and grandchildren, to show these people and saying, I have immunized my children, and yet my children will not be safe until your children are safe, and I care about all the world's children. I think this is the message we must get out as people, as Rotarians and caring community to community.
David Heyman, I understood that a few months ago it was the religious leaders in Nigeria who did come around, change their mind, and say the vaccinations should go ahead.
Yes, actually, we are seeing now that there is a change in perception about the vaccine. The vaccines are known to be safe now, even to the governor of Kano, with whom I just spoke 2 hours ago. And the governor has now developed plans for beginning immunization campaigns, although he has not yet announced the dates. So we're seeing that through a consensus-building process within Nigeria, and this, again, is a democracy with a need to build consensus, but with that consensus-building process, we finally arrived at an area where immunizations will begin very shortly. How soon, we're not yet certain, but we hope to know more tomorrow.
Barbara, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening.
And let's get more information on the fight on the ground against polio. Joining us now is Dr. Elias Duri as the WHO's polio coordinator in the Horn of Africa. He has firsthand experience with battling this disease. He joins us on the phone from Cairo, Egypt. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Welcome. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about where you've been working.
Yeah, like a lot of other polio eradication people who've been working in polio eradication, we work in Yemen, South Sudan, Somalia, and a lot of other African countries also.
Tell us a little bit of what it's like in those areas regarding polio. How bad is it?
Polio has been, as you may have heard before, polio has been endemic in a lot of countries for some years. But with a great job and dedication of the community and the government and the partnerships. We have reached really a very successful result in these areas. And the last case we had is really in October of 2002 in Somalia. And since then, we continue to do surveillance, but we have not seen the case yet.
There was, we're told, and as David Heyman has been telling us, an outbreak in Darfur in the western part of Sudan.
Yeah, this is part of the recent cross-border reinfection of a lot of other African countries, which, as David said, comes from the Western Africa.
What is the biggest problem you face in terms of going into communities? You try to, I assume, work with local health officials, local politicians, local religious leaders, the community, to try to get everybody involved.
Well, you know, in the areas that we've been working, actually, we did not have much of local government or anything like that, especially in a place like Somalia. But I think we decided from the beginning that we are not going to wait for peace to eradicate polio. So we come up with strategies that really will allow us to reach almost every child in every part of the country, be it in Somalia or South Sudan. So we had to use whatever we had, including developing our own infrastructure and really closely working with the community and coming up with days of tranquility, cross-border negotiation, and so on. So it's not been easy, but it has been very successful.
As you noted, there is, no central government, at least in Somalia. There's been a war underway in southern Sudan for some time now. This can't, as you say, this can't be easy. There must be a lot of logistical problems and a lot of security concerns as well.
Exactly.
Do you face a lot of mistrust?
Well, you know, as has been said, you know, polio eradication is one of the things that a lot of governments also really took this as a priority activities, and there was a very good collaboration with the Sudanese government to allow us to enter into these difficult areas. But in South Sudan, more than that, the difficulty was really lack of infrastructure.
Lack of infrastructure. That's
which. Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
We also tried to manage by utilizing whatever possible things that we have there and also establishing some infrastructure ourselves, which has led to, as a polio, to be one of the only infrastructure that is available now to reach every part of the country, which again could be used for a lot of other public health interventions and disease control.
Dr. Duri, thanks very much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Elias Duri works on the fight against polio in the Horn of Africa for WHO. He joined us by phone from Cairo and Egypt. And David Heyman, just about a minute or so left in this segment, you were said earlier you were confident that polio would still eventually be eradicated despite these most recent setbacks. What gives you the confidence?
Well, the world has pulled together around polio and invested 3.1 billion U.S. dollars in its eradication, and the world is not yet ready to let go of it. What we need to do is remember that in public health there are always ups and downs, and when the downs come, we can't give up. We have to just keep moving ahead, and that's what we're doing in West Africa. We will now be having, with the countries involved, 22 country synchronized immunization campaigns in October and November of this year, which we hope, after Nigeria has caught up, will finish polio in West Africa.
Thank you very much. Please stay with us, though, because we want to talk about malaria when we come back from the break. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, if you'd like to join the conversation, or send us an email, TOTN@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about battling infectious disease in poor countries, especially diseases that have been eradicated in the developed world. We're taking your calls. We'd particularly like to hear from listeners who have experience working in public health overseas. Our number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@npr.org. Our guest is David Heyman, the former executive director of communicable diseases for the World Health Organization, and he's with us in Geneva. And we turn now to another devastating disease, malaria. Every year, this accounts for more than 1 million deaths, most of them young children in sub-Saharan Africa. Treatment exists, and prevention is very possible. Access, though, is said to be the biggest problem. But Dr. Heyman, is that a fair summation?
That's an excellent summation. In fact, malaria is a disease that also was present in the United States. And this disease was present in the southern states. And in fact, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta was at one time the malaria control center for the U.S. But through access to medicines, through bed nets, through control of the mosquitoes that transmit malaria, it's now gone from the U.S. The problem is that malaria now remains endemic or prevalent throughout developing countries in tropical areas. And this disease is a disease which kills children very rapidly. There are drugs which are available to treat this and cure the infection. There are also means such as mosquito nets which can prevent mosquitoes from biting children as they sleep. And there are also other possibilities to control the mosquito in the community. These all must be used if we're to bring malaria under control, but access has been a problem in most developing countries.
What is it medically about this disease that differentiates it from, say, polio, which you can have a goal of eradication?
Polio has a vaccine which can prevent infection. Malaria, despite millions of dollars invested in research, does not yet have a vaccine, so infection cannot be prevented by a vaccine. What's necessary in malaria is to find children as soon as they develop a fever which might be malaria and treat them for malaria and keep them under a bed net. It's a different disease. It's a high mortality disease. It kills children very rapidly, whereas polio paralyzes children, and most of them remain alive to be paralyzed for life.
Let's get a caller on the line. Philip is with us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I am working on a USAID-funded project called Measure Evaluation, which supports developing countries to improve their capacity to monitor their progress in fighting these diseases. And I've just come from 6 years of directing such a project in East Africa, in Tanzania. And I think one point that needs to be made is that in setting global priorities, we still lack fundamental information about the numbers of people who are dying, both in absolute terms and from different causes of death. Only in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, only South Africa has complete vital registration data that helps derive these statistics with reliable cause of death data. Kenya has decent coverage, but the cause of death data has not been yet proved. So we've got a huge problem in terms of even being able to set evidence-based priorities and to understand not only the persistent problems such as malaria and polio, but the emergent epidemics of obesity that are affecting increasing numbers of people in the developing world. So at the same time as all the resources are marshaled in the millennial campaigns to eradicate polio, to control malaria, tuberculosis, and HIV/AIDS, we also have to bear in mind that investments in information and in understanding our progress in these things have to be made alongside the action and the intervention.
David Heyman, do you agree?
Yes, I agree completely. We have a very rudimentary understanding of where diseases are occurring and how they're occurring. But we do know enough from surveys that have been done in villages, from special studies, we do know enough to know that of the 14 million deaths which are occurring from infectious diseases, or the approximate 14 million deaths each year, 90% of them are due just to six infectious processes. And that includes diarrheal diseases in children, it includes malaria, it includes tuberculosis, it includes AIDS, it includes measles, and it includes respiratory infections. So we know that 90% of these diseases are caused by, 90% of these deaths are caused by six specific diseases, but we don't know what the dynamics of these diseases are, how they might change from year to year. We don't know the fine-tuning, if you would, because we don't have good surveillance systems or disease tracking systems in countries.
Yeah, if I may, I'd like just to add to that a little bit. In fact, we have an okay picture about the mortality of children. Adult mortality is still largely unknown. even from the basis of surveys, from population-based surveys, we really do not have an accurate empirical picture. And the projections that we're making and the models that we're making are certainly better than guessing. However, we can and should be doing better in this day and age of strengthening systems within developing countries to monitor the health conditions within their own populations and to be able to simply count the dead and determine what people are dying from at all ages, not just among children. Thank you.
Thanks, Philip. Here's an email we got from Aaron Larkspur. I read in a New Yorker article of early July 2001 about Fred Soper, the man who stopped a malaria outbreak in a South American country in the 1930s and dreamed of eliminating malaria worldwide in the 1950s and early 60s by spraying houses aggressively with DDT. His program slowly ground to a halt despite official support of many countries and a huge army of workers. Please comment on his quest. Also, is going after the mosquitoes still our best option to control malaria?
In the malaria eradication efforts that were undertaken in the 1950s, there was a major emphasis on DDT and spraying of houses. What happened, though, was that the mosquitoes became resistant to this insecticide, and the spraying of the houses was not, in the end, effective in completely controlling vectors, the mosquito vectors. At the same time, there were efforts to control vectors in water, where they breed. The mosquito breeding site is in water, and in various other attempts. But these all, in the end, were highly unsuccessful, except for a few parts of the world where eradication was completed. These were mainly island nations in the Pacific, or places which were closed to international travel.
So it is DDT is hardly a panacea, and obviously DDT also has serious environmental effects.
That's right, and today DDT is not recommended, although it's still used until another insecticide can be found that can replace it, because DDT is very inexpensive and countries can afford DDT, whereas other insecticides they can't afford. So some countries continue to use DDT in spraying the walls of their households where mosquitoes land and then die because they're in contact with DDT in the majority of cases.
Joining us now from his office in Guatemala City, Guatemala, is Mauricio Sauerbrey, director of Onco-Circiasis, the elimination program of the Americas for the Carter Center. He worked on the outbreak of malaria in El Salvador during the 1980s and 90s, and it's good of you to join us today. Hello, Mauricio Sauerbrey.
Yes.
Hi. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm here in Guatemala, and previously said, I used to work for the malaria program in El Salvador with the funding from the USAID. Malaria program in El Salvador, the problem with malaria in El Salvador was really a very difficult circumstances. It was the third cause of morbidity, just under the diarrhea and respiratory disease in 1980, and used to record 100,000 cases in a country that only has 21,000 square kilometers. So, and those, the most difficult situation was that out of those 100,000 cases, 17,000 cases were due to Plasmodium falciparum, the most severe form of the malaria.
Mm-hmm.
And through the assistance of the USAID with the government of El Salvador, at the end of 1995, it was a 95% reduction in cases. And the country was reporting at that time only 3,000 cases, new cases, and no Plasmodium falciparum. And the most important thing is that that situation up to this year, it continues exactly the same thing with very few cases of malaria, and despite that all neighboring countries, surrounding countries, still have significant problems of the malaria.
What worked?
Yes?
What worked?
Well, what happened is that really we thought that probably the best option was not to base only on one measure to control malaria, but rather using a source of different measures with one condition very important, with to do timely according to a surveillance system and a decentralization of the decision-making, to take it all the way to the field by a empowerment of the people of the malaria control program. The most important of those measures was, of course, the timely treatment. Treatment was provided in these circumstances at the field level, at the community levels, by volunteer collaborators, well-trained, who had all the drugs available to be able to deliver treatment immediately to the persons that presented to their places with symptoms. That gave us the tremendous advantage of reducing the potential for continuing transmission. And in addition, the treatment that was included in the Salvadorian program was a combined treatment of primaquine and chloroquine. The primaquine is directed toward the tissue forms of the parasite and the chloroquine to the blood that produces the blood forms that produce the symptoms. By using primaquine at the same time, we were able to knock out really the infection with falciparum because since it was timely treatment, less than 72 hours after symptoms appear, it reduces the gametocytes, which were the infected forms of the Plasmodium falciparum.
Okay. I understand you're now working on onchocerciasis, better known as river blindness, but isn't that a disease that was thought to be stamped out some time ago?
Well, no. Onchocerciasis has been a disease that was introduced into the New World about 500 years ago by the slave trade. And even though onchocerciasis is not really a prominent disease among the public health important diseases, however, onchocerciasis has one important characteristic in Latin America that is an eliminable disease. So that's why it has been a good partnership, public and national, multiple coalition that has been formed in order to eradicate and eliminate the disease from the six endemic countries in Latin America, which are Mexico, Guatemala, Colombia, Ecuador, Venezuela, and Brazil. Of course, this is based upon the discovery of Merck of a drug that can be used massive in communities. So the idea is to treat everybody that is eligible to receive the treatment in among all the 1,950 communities endemic for the disease throughout the six countries. The importance of this approach is that by forming a partnership organization with the public sector and the national governments has been the key issue for this, and they are key elements in that of members that have been playing a tremendous role, like is the Carter Center. They have taken the responsibility for the management of all this initiative in a standardized way. There is another member that should be highlighted in this partnership, which is the Lions Club. As you know, Lions Club have the site's first project that deals with prevention of blindness all over the world, and that's why they were interested in onchocerciasis, and especially from the point of view that this is a disease that is going to be eliminated.
Maurizio Sauerbrei, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Maurizio Sauerbrei is director of the Onchocerciasis Elimination Program for the Americas for the Carter Center, and he joined us by phone from his office in Guatemala City. We're talking about the worldwide fight against infectious disease. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another listener on the line, and this is Mary, who's with us from Bethesda, Maryland.
Hello, yes. I'm a pediatrician, and I worked for 2 years with no salary at WHO in Geneva. So my comments are more on the general approach from these international organizations and where politics interferes with the work. We know it interferes in the countries because of their political bent, but it also interferes when each of the countries, including the U.S., sends people to these organizations who are not of quality. When David Heyman came, it was like a breath of fresh air. He was incredible. But we still have some of our colleagues in European nations who feel there's too much evidence we use from the U.S. But in reviewing the literature for some of the conditions that WHO was working on, there were not adequately done studies in other countries, but they refused to accept the American studies that I found. So I think this is really a concern that interferes in the end result. The people working there are all paid well. Their children go to private schools. And I always said they'll try to stamp out hunger and disease, but there'll be one child left in the world, and that child will still die while everybody gets their money.
David Heyman, how much is politics a problem?
Well, politics are important in public health because it's politics that drive public health. The thing that can't be done in public health is to make decisions in public health based on the politics. You make the decision based on the public health evidence, then you mobilize this decision through the political system within the country. So in the end, it's the political system which drives public health. But the basic understanding must be, as Mary said, from the literature, from the evidence that we know, that we understand, and which is unbiased. So it's a very difficult task in making sure that you don't mix the politics and the evidence. But we try our best to do that, and in most instances through an international consensus process with experts from around the world, we're able to do just that.
David Heyman, we've looked at two diseases, and of course there are many others. We've mentioned just a few of them. Who is it that determines which diseases get the most attention?
Well, it should be the countries who decide which disease they will spend most of their resources on. But in many places, countries are driven by the donor dollar, what the donor countries will give and where they will place that dollar. So many times, though they try to set their own priorities, these priorities are driven by the priorities of the international community. We try to work with countries to help them determine their priorities and to invest in those priorities. But it's a constant effort to keep focus on the priorities and not to move into areas that are less important because there's money there.
Mary, thank you very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Yes, and David Heyman was a real benefit. It was good that U.S. sent him.
I'm sure he appreciates your kind words, too. Thanks very much for the phone call.
Sure thing.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. When we come back from a break, we'll take a couple more questions on the questions of communicable diseases around the world and some of the broader picture questions that remain unaddressed thus far with David Heyman. We're also going to be talking about two Supreme Court decisions that were announced today. We'll find out what the Supreme Court had to say about Vice President Cheney's Energy Task Force and about hundreds of death penalty cases that may have been affected by an earlier Supreme Court ruling on the question of whether judges are qualified to issue sentences in capital cases. So stay tuned for a conversation about that. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In a minute, David Savage of the Los Angeles Times joins us to discuss today's Supreme Court decisions, but we want to wrap up our discussion on infectious diseases with David Heyman, former executive director of communicable diseases for the World Health Organization. He's currently involved in the polio eradication initiative at WHO. And I wanted to ask you, David Heyman, what about the pharmaceutical companies? How do they influence strategies in the fight against disease?
In the fight against diseases, there's a role for every group and every person, and that includes the pharmaceutical companies. Pharmaceutical companies drive the research and development which is necessary for new antibiotics, new vaccines, new goods that are used in developing countries. At the same time, these goods are many times too expensive to be purchased by developing countries, and that's where it's important that others come in to play a role. There are the activists who keep reminding us all that prices must come down at some point. There are the international organizations who try to pull the all the different parties together. There are the countries themselves which must take medicines once they get them and get them into their systems and to their people. There are NGOs who must work with governments to do the same job. And then there are the governments where pharmaceutical industries are present. And these governments must also work to make sure that the industry has the benefits it needs to provide and produce the goods for developing countries. So all must play a role. It's very interesting that just a few years ago, maybe 15 years ago, if you went to a development agency such as USAID or the development agency in the United Kingdom and asked if they would provide funding for medicines to treat infections, the answer was usually no, but we will provide vaccines. Today, that's all changed because these agencies understand that health must be at the center of economic development, and the major infectious disease killers today don't have vaccines. As a result, there are new initiatives, the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and Malaria, which is a $5 billion investment which will provide funding to countries to purchase drugs, to purchase the medicines necessary. So there's a good, healthy environment today in which there is a market for drugs, there is a purchasing power for those drugs, and there's also the goodwill of the development agencies to do the job and to get these drugs to the countries. It's up to the countries now to be committed enough to get them further out in their systems and to continue to work to get more resources for these drugs and these medicines.
Let's get another caller on the line. Bernard joins us from Baltimore.
Oh, thanks. I wanted to raise a concern about strategy with Dave Heyman. I've worked in countries in sub-Saharan Africa now for some 30 years and worked in Cameroon when just before David was there. My concern is about vertical programs. As I go back to Africa now, I'm seeing too many vertical programs.
What do you mean by vertical programs?
These are programs per disease. You've heard now about malaria. You've heard about polio. You've heard about onchocerciasis. We could talk about immunization, diarrheal disease, now integration of childhood illness, et cetera. And in ministries, these programs line up against each other. They compete for resources. Some of them get vehicles from one source, others from another. It creates a problem within the ministries themselves about how they carry these programs out. And the priorities are not coming from the countries themselves. I think very few countries would have chosen polio eradication as a priority use for some $3 billion across the world. So I think what I want them to comment on is, one, priority setting. Some others have already asked about that. The other is, how do we begin to use the sort of several generations of, in this case, Africans that we've trained in schools of public health all around the world to be experts in these areas? How do we get them to do local epidemiology, local studies, and develop local strategies? And that's important because it leads to sustainability. I don't think these programs that are being funded by international organizations with all the directions coming from Geneva or New York are sustainable, whereas training a generation of people in sub-Saharan African countries, developing local institutions, will be sustainable.
David Heyman?
Yeah, I think those are very important points, and I think we all have that difficulty in seeing what we like to call vertical programs, getting the resources and other diseases maybe being pushed aside. But take, for example, polio eradication. This program began in 1988 with a resolution in the World Health Assembly. That means that ministers of health from the 192 member countries of WHO agreed that this was their priority to get rid of polio and that they would invest in this. At the same time, partners came in to help to eradicate that disease with the resources, and the resources have been spent. The challenge is to make sure that what's going on in a vertical program, such as polio eradication, benefits the whole health system, and that's sometimes very difficult, although it does happen. For example, in polio eradication, there's a micro-planning procedure at the community level, which is planning on how to get the vaccine to the people, mapping the area, getting the vaccines out. These maps also now are serving for the malaria control program and the 3x5 initiative to treat AIDS in those same communities. Tuberculosis programs recommend direct observed treatment short course, which means that people receive drugs under supervision from health workers. Those health workers are now trained in supervision for tuberculosis. They can supervise the administration of other drugs, such as those for HIV. So the challenge is not so much to avoid these vertical programs, which will occur because there are resolutions behind them, because there is funding, but to use these programs to establish something within the health system which can then benefit other diseases in that same health system.
Thank you very much, Bernard, for the phone call.
Let me express my appreciation for David's hard work over the last 30 years.
Well, it's the David Heyman Fan Club.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. David Heyman, we're going to thank you, too.
Thank you very much
for your time. We appreciate it. David Heyman, former executive director of communicable diseases for the World Health Organization, and he joined us from the WHO studios in Geneva, Switzerland.